Good morning.
Good morning.
Any of you in the back want to move up closer, feel free. My name's Michael Zimmerman Mugaku. I'm the teacher here today. Diane's running a women's retreat in Torrey over Valentine's weekend. She'll be back next week. How many of you are new? Just a couple, okay. This question, how did you hear about us? Any of you? Yes.
She heard about it from me.
She heard about it from you. Okay, that's mouth, word of mouth. Anybody else?
Yeah, I saw it online.
Online, the web?
Online, yeah.
Okay, great. So, what did Diane do last week? I wasn't here. And anybody was here last?
We talked about awe.
You talked about who?
Awe, like wonder.
Awe, wonder. That's pretty cool. So what I was thinking I would talk about, how many of you have a meditation practice of some kind? Okay. So what are you doing, anybody, what are you doing in it? Raise your hand, and with the woman in the black sweater. Okay, does anyone want to run the mic?
Mm-hmm. So the reason why we use the mic is just because we're recording for people that aren't here and
Yeah, you raise your hand.
Okay.
You're in my line of sight.
Yeah. Just carving out time for myself to be in silence and allow my mind to settle and just to be create patience in me and different paradigm, I think, how I approach this.
And So what comes up when you're meditating?
It depends on the day. Sometimes mm-hmm. very little, and other times a lot of
thoughts,
thinking.
Or is it emotions, or?
I think mostly thinking and planning. I'm always planning.
Okay.
Something.
All right. So anybody else? Anybody something different? Thinking and planning. Yeah. What's your name?
Jamie.
Thank you.
The past comes up frequently, memories also, so not just the future, but the past.
And what do you do with them when they come up?
Well, the idea for me is to go back to focusing on my breathing or whatever it is I'm singularly focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it takes a couple of minutes before I realize I've wandered off the course for quite a ways before I go back.
Okay. And what happens to the thoughts and the memories when you come back?
I don't know.
Okay. Anybody else? Something else? Anything? A little variation? Yeah, right up here. Just say your name, please.
Derek. Descending into the body. Ajrayana Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
Just bringing my attention currently to tension that I'm feeling and just being with that.
And what do you do with thoughts when they come up?
Notice and let them go.
Okay.
Sometimes I get carried away.
Sometimes. Okay. Well, one of the sort of principle, you know, Buddhism is essentially psychological. It's probably the most sophisticated of the traditions psychologically. People have spent, you know, some time in the last 2,500 years looking inward and sort of categorizing how the mind works and how we create a world with our minds. When I say mind, I don't just mean what's up here. I mean the mind-body, because they're so intimately connected neurologically and every hormonally. They're not really separate. But the teaching is, and the teaching is just based on practice, it isn't like the teaching is an abstract given, is that if you look inward and you think about it, don't think about it, experiencing it, everything that occurs in the world of which you are aware arises in your mind. It isn't to say there isn't anything out there, but it's to say what you know, that of which you are aware, all arises in your consciousness. There's no place else for it to be. And your consciousness right now, because we're a creature that evolves, that can think, that imagines, that remembers, that has a past and a future, and we adapt to our environment, so we learn what's dangerous, what's not dangerous, what nourishes us, what doesn't. We create narratives, stories. We create habit patterns, how we're going to respond to phenomena, things in the environment, how we're going to respond to our emotions, how we're going to meet our needs. So all of this is constructed out of your experience, the five senses, feelings, the feelings, the emotions that arise in the body, your experience of others, your culture. And you develop all of these, and you also develop, quite obviously, a sense of who you are as a separate creature, what your habit patterns are, what your attitudes are. You have a sense of your physicality. So you develop a pretty hard sense of a self. And this self exists apart from everything else. But again, it's all in your mind. The whole thing is created in your mind from inputs, and from experience, which then you make into memory. And you also have, there's a part of your brain actually up here, the default mode network, when you're not really occupied in the present moment, like in a task or something, you ruminate. You may do so consciously, usually unconsciously. You're turning over your experience, what's happened in the past. Did it work? Did it not work? Did what I do today work or not work? How am I going to deal with this in the future? So that you're laying down these patterns. You're continually laying these patterns down and refining them, solidifying your sense of self, and solidifying what you know about the world, about yourself, about all the experience that's happened in your consciousness over the course of your lifetime. And the Buddha's, he was just a teacher, and the people who followed him just followed this sort of psychological introspective path. But he said, so the first truth about being human is dukkha, which means essentially unsatisfactoriness. That being human necessarily brings with it unsatisfactoriness, a sense of dis-ease, that things aren't quite the way they're supposed to be. Does anybody resonate with that? That's all? Two people. The rest of you, I don't know what the hell you're here for.
Well, this place works so well for us.
Good.
For all it is.
Good, I'm glad to hear that. So you could... And he said, you know, there's a reason for it, and the reason for it is, he says, greed, anger, and ignorance. Now, that's shorthand for, I want things I don't have. The I wants things it doesn't have. It has things it doesn't want, can't get rid of. And that it fundamentally doesn't understand the nature of itself and its relation to reality. So the remedy is getting a better sense of how you construct reality, how your constructed sense of self creates expectations So, yeah, why do you have dissatisfaction? Because you're expecting something you're not getting, right? Implicitly, and sometimes explicitly, the world is supposed to be a little different than it is. There's some moments when the world is congruent with my mind, my expectations, who I am, who I think I am, how I think the world functions. Those are what we would call moments of homeostasis, equipoise. Your body tells you things are good. It feels good. It feels safe. It's open. Everything's going smoothly. And then there are moments when your expectations, your patterns, yourself, incongruent with the inputs you're getting from the world, your senses, the actions of others. They're conflicting with your habitual stories and your notion of who you are, your fixed ideas. And you want this to be different, right? Because this is who you are. It's the self you've created in your mind. It's all of its expectations. It's stories how the world should be. It's stories of how the past was and how the future should be. So it's past and future oriented. And if you're past and future oriented like this and you have a narrative line that runs through the present moment, you what? You have picked out from everything that ever occurred in the past a selected group of bits of information that you've put together into your story. Right? And you've projected it into the future because it's a narrative line, it's a storyline. It doesn't come here and go this way, it comes here and goes out there. So you expect a selected group of phenomena in the future to continue the story you've made out of your past. Now, sometimes do you think your story of the past is maybe a little selective? Maybe a little affected by your emotional response to experiences you've had? That subtly affects your expectations of the future. So the through line you've drawn isn't necessarily the only through line, right? There's a lot of through lines. You could go this way, you could go this way, you might even go all these ways. But you have subtle expectations of what it's going to be. And when reality doesn't quite fit them, if you don't really know why you're feeling discomfort, it's probably because of it. And sometimes quite vividly, you know there's a disjunct between your expectations and what's arising. So the Buddhist remedy or the suggested remedy is if you look, you have this solid sense of how things should be and who you are. But that if you actually sit quietly, and it's referred to generally as turning the light within, turn your attention within, and just watch what's arising moment to moment, that you can become much more familiar with the way this mind, this body-mind, experiences phenomena moment to moment. And you begin to see that the sense of self is really kind of not concrete, that it changes. And if you also are doing that in the present moment, wholly in the present moment, your sense of self is built out of a story, right, which comes from the past to the future. If you're just in the present moment, right this second, and this second, and this second, there's no story. If there's no story, your sense of self fades. And as you said, why does it feel good? Oh my God, all those expectations are gone. All that history's gone. There's nothing I need right now. There's nothing I've got to get rid of. I don't feel oppositional. I don't feel threatened. If I could be like this every moment, that would be awe. Awesome. Yeah.
I love the way all of this sounds, like coming into my ears.
But.
And I trust it.
And it's hard.
Well, it's hard on many levels, and part of the dis-ease that I deal with is anchored in my fear my fear of not belonging.
Okay.
And I realize that that's way up in the ego, you know, where we should spend a lot less time. But so
no.
my sense of self that I construct might be going this way, and I might be tricking myself into that story. But my sense of self also goes the other direction as I get feedback from other people on who my self is to them.
Right, okay.
And I get tangled up in that a little bit. And
okay.
I asked you a question for Christmas sometime. I don't remember when it was. And you shared something with me that was so important and has become a really profound part of my practice that I did not anticipate. And you mentioned I had asked you about, I had a struggle with letting go of things, which I was getting better about, but particularly relationships. I struggled with relationships, letting go of that. And you told me to practice stop seeing the other person as somebody to me or something that I needed from them along those lines. And so an active meditation for me has become to, when I'm interacting with another person, as I do sometimes in a silent meditation of my own, when my mind wanders and I say, come back. When I'm with another person, I find myself going down that same road and weaving a story about who they are to me and what I need from them. And so I practice saying, come back, and then stopping and looking at that person as completely unrelated and detached from me, and just try and see them as a person.
Okay.
That's been so helpful to me, but I still get pitched a little bit on that story that from the feedback I get.
Well, and we are deeply connected creatures. I mean, humans, E.O. Wilson, who's the entomologist, the guy who studies ants, says that humans are the only mammal that is what he calls eusocial. In other words, we are essentially hive creatures like ants and termites and bees. So connection, we have neurological systems that are intimately aware of what's going around us with other humans and dogs. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of creatures have this sort of communal sense, and we have a lot of that. But that's also input that you're getting. You could say you're not getting it from what you would think of as the five senses, but you're getting it from your neurological system moment to moment. And we do have, mammals have a need for connection. That's why parents don't, you know, we don't have eggs and leave them somewhere. You know, we raise life. And to do that, you need to have a great sense of connection. But in meditation, the suggestion in meditation is if you can be in the present moment and look inward and recognize sort of, we're going to do this in a moment, sitting. If you can simply try to be awareness and not be the thoughts in awareness, in other words, be the space, the consciousness that knows rather than the things that are known, you can watch phenomena arising in your consciousness moment to moment, which includes feelings, includes thoughts, and you can see them as things in your consciousness. Sounds, smell, taste, touch, thoughts. And that if you turn your attention on them in the moment when they arise, thoughts, for example, you can watch them. What happens when you look at them? This was said over here. If you look at a thought, as a phenomena, like a sound, like a smell, watch it. What happens? Well, it might give rise to an emotion. Can you just sit with that emotion? That's a phenomena. What happens with that? Well, like everything else that comes through your consciousness moment to moment, it changes and disappears and something else comes in. If you just sit in the moment and watch, if you can treat everything that bubbles up in your body and mind as something in your awareness and just watch them, you are the awareness. You are not the things that are arising. You are the awareness. You're not the thought. If the thought starts to grab you, look at it clearly. Focus your attention on it. You have this spacious awareness. Bring it into focus. Look at the thought. What's that taste like? What's it feel like? What's it doing? And I think you'll find it will be like any other phenomena that will just dissipate. Just be present to it. And if you can hold, just one second, if you can hold that space, that present moment, spacious awareness, none of it's threatening. I mean, somebody yesterday, we had a day of Zen, and they were talking to me, you know, I had this experience of grief when I was sitting. But the difference was, instead of pushing it away, I just sort of watched it fill my awareness and sort of got a sense of what it was like. And then it faded away. But she said, in the process, I learned something about that experience. And it wasn't threatening particularly. It wasn't an emotional upper. But it just was a fact. Just an experience. And she wasn't telling a story about it. So if you can actually experience these phenomena, including everything that arises, your stories, as simply things that come up in consciousness that you can look at, if you watch them, they won't stay very long. So your whole sense of their truth, which you unconsciously you attach them to your storyline. You unconsciously attach them to the narrative arc that runs from your past to your future. But if you just got them right here, there's no story there. So the point of all of this is, if you do this, the idea is, and I think the experience of people for a couple of thousand years is, subtly, you won't see, this isn't a conscious thing, but subtly, your belief in the stories, in the structures that you've built about how the world should be and who I am, are subtly weakened. They become what I would call provisional truths. Provisional truth is a truth that's good so long as it works. And when it stops working, there must be some other truth, right? It isn't like, because these are personal psychological truths. These are not concrete you know, that. These are truths by which you're living your life, truths by which you think the world works. And when they don't work out, when they're not useful psychologically, don't be attached to them. There must be some other perspective. And the other thing doing that kind of practice does is it weakens your sense of separate self. In other words, it weakens your sense of your story being who you are. You may actually be much more flexible, much more pliable, much less predictable, much more able to respond supplely to what comes up in your life, much more stable, much less fearful, because if you can sit in the present moment with your awareness just extended, like the sky extends over the earth and the phenomena on the earth don't disturb the sky. If you can sit that way, that's a comfortable place to be. That's a safe place to be. Grief comes up, sadness comes up, happiness comes up. Cool. Interesting. Awesome. But that's just living my life moment to moment. And don't worry, your stories won't go away. Your sense of separate self won't go away, but it can become more flexible and more, you can question things more. And then when the world is this way and you're this way, you can sort of say, oh, maybe the problem isn't out here, that the people I'm around aren't acting the way I want them to. Maybe it's the wanting to. Maybe if I change my perspective, I'll feel equanimous and calm and competent and capable and curious. Gosh, I'm not quite who I thought it was. The world isn't quite the way I thought it was. So that's what the practice is about. And that's all it's about. And it's not easy. It doesn't sound easy, but it actually isn't that hard to sit and hold spacious awareness. It comes up. Watch what comes up in this moment, not some past moment. Don't link it to something else. Don't project it into the future. What's going on right this minute? Because you don't live your life in the past and future. You live it only in moments. So that's, we can do some of that. You had a question, I'm sorry. I got going, so. One of my problems, one of my stories.
Actually, I think you speaking really, I don't know, I think it was helpful, so, you know, thank you for continuing to go. I think what I've been sitting here thinking is that I have a hard time sometimes knowing the difference between intuition, or I'm curious what your thoughts are on intuition. Like, is intuition your, like, the story of the past? I mean, it's probably hard to just have an intuition. We probably take some of that history from the past or things like that. So I think I have a hard time knowing what's intuition, what's dissatisfaction, what is just some old baggage I'm taking. And I totally understand what you're saying about sitting in present awareness, and I feel like when I've gone to like silent 7-day retreats or things like that, I feel completely satisfied, and all I'm doing is sitting and walking and eating, and I could not want anything more. Like, it's kind of strange how gratifying it is, but then when I leave that environment, you know, there's other people sure. around me, you know.
Yeah, so it's the other people are the problem.
Like, I'm okay with it just being. But I don't know if that makes sense.
So then it makes total sense.
Story of like, okay, well, I'm fine when I'm just with me. Like, so then when these things of dissatisfaction. reaction or intuition mm-hmm. or whatever. Is it something I need to change? Do I need to fix something? And
I would say no. So what do you think intuition is? I would guess intuition is, so let's assume this creature, this animal, evolved over, you know, from bacteria up to what we are now, has all kinds of subtle, you know, learnings of which we're not aware, habit patterns, mechanisms for coping with its environment, and it always wants to feel homeostasis. It always wants to feel safe, comfortable, that it's getting what it needs, calmness, all of that. And it's telling, you could say your intuition is probably a combination of your history and subtle feeling and emotion state inputs of which you don't have, you know, you didn't make them up. And some of them are patterns, some of them are part of your conditioning, and some are just inherent in being this creature. So when you experience them, I think you can just be present to them too. So if you can just, and you say you like, you know, when you're doing sitting, but then when you go back to the world, it gets to be sticky. If you're just sitting at your desk or you're, you know, taking 2 or 3 minutes where you're quiet, you can do this. You can reach, you can do it right this moment. Just reach out with your senses as though you were, I wasn't looking at you, but I'm looking in my peripheral vision. I'm trying to focus on the absolute limits of what I can see to the side. Okay, try that. And what happens when you do that is you can't focus on one thing. You simply see light and dark, colors, shapes, right? If I'm just seeing light and dark, color, shapes, I'm not attaching to any of them. I might notice one and, you know, notice there's a bunch of them, but they kind of are dancing in awareness. If I'm just focusing on staying as broadly aware as possible. And you can do this wide up with your eyes open because your vision is a huge part of your sense of what the present moment is. That's what you can do with your mind with regard to everything that's arising in this moment, every feeling in your body, thoughts. You can do the same thing. And if you do that and you feel an intuition and you want to focus on it, just let it blossom. Let the feeling come up in your body. Notice, is there an emotion? What's it like? Just be present. Don't start telling a story that it's good or bad. Just let it be. Let it blossom. Let it fade. Notice what it is. Then when it's gone, come back to the broad vision. You're just learning. You're just being informed by phenomena. And you can do that any place. You can do that. I do it in the office. I have little cues in my iPhone because I get so, you know, I'm a lawyer and I have a terrible time that I get so monomaniacal. And when I do that, God, my whole world softens. And it's easy to do. And the more you do that, the more you realize, wow, this is a state, this is not reality. This is the way my body mind gets when it's on a task. But when I go back to this, the whole world softens, eases up. I realize this is kind of maniacal, sometimes useful, but boy, I don't want to be there all the time. So is that helpful?
Yeah.
was really helpful. I think as you were talking, I was thinking that, you know, I've, and even your, you know, basically it's just another state. Like, I think I hold it at a higher level.
Exactly.
And so it's like, well, if this is intuition, then I need to do something about it. Right. Or it could be just a feeling, you know, and I think I get so caught up on that and labeling it and why it is what it is. And so just kind of treating it as anything else that comes into my awareness, I think is really...
It doesn't mean it's not useful. It doesn't mean it doesn't inform you. But the reason that I say try to just be present instead of letting stories about it come up is because stories, a way to think of stories is, so here's the flow of the moments. Just sit here for a moment. With your take your consciousness and stretch it out the same way I'm stretching my arms out. Imagine it's your peripheral vision. Just look at the things at the farthest corner of your vision. Now you're not prizing. So what's coming up in your body? Feel all the sensations in your body in this moment. What's the sense of sitting on your butt? What's the feeling of the air on your skin? The light in your eyes? Smell? Ringing in your ears? Sound? What do you feel like inside your body? Stomach growling? A little hurt here and there? An itch? Watch them come. Watch them go. It's like a kaleidoscope, you know, those little things where you turn them and the rocks tumble and you see different visions of things. None of this... Well, I'll ask you, does any of these phenomena have separate important meaning to you?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, sure.
Well, you do, and you're talking. So, I mean, I guess, yeah, my attention is on...
Yeah, but just I want you to just pay attention to yourself. I mean, turn your eye inward.
No, there really wasn't. Nothing was like a higher importance than anything in that moment.
Right. To make it important, I have to take it out of my experience in the moment. I have to pull it out of experiential reality, and I have to give it a characteristic about why it's important, and then I have to tie it into something. Right? And once I've done that, what have I done to the experience in the moment? I've distorted my experience by focusing, by picking out items that I think it's important to know and tying them into stories and categorizing them and building my conceptual world, building the world that I live in. I'm ornamenting the house of my world. Right? Changing the, enhancing the decor, getting a new chair, you know, that's what I'm doing. And the more I do that, the more I solidify the world I live in. That's fine. It's useful. But when you do this, you recognize that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm kind of constructing my imagined world. And just doing that over time subtly tells you that's a provisional truth. And if you know it's provisional in your gut, in your unconscious, even in your consciousness, you're much less distressed when this happens. Because you know this is something I've made up. Yeah, question?
Yeah, I had a question.
Sure.
It has a lot to do with, like,
take the mic so people can hear you in the back.
There's like some kind of question in it, but there's like these dualities of acceptance and ego.
Yeah.
kind of what's come up this week is nothing matters but the story we tell ourselves. And there's this adaptation of, I guess, accepting the story that you tell yourself in order to, like, I guess, go about your life.
Right.
This struggle of, like, ego, happiness. And if ego exists, which it does exist, I guess.
Well, the idea of it exists.
I mean, it's just like so many things in our lives that are kind of like centered around ego.
Sure, self. Let's just talk itself, because it isn't a bad thing. You know?
I guess that's what I'm like viewing it as, but it's just like getting up a hill. It's like these challenges that we kind of accept in life, but just expanding on, you know, story. Like these stories that we tell ourselves. Like we all exist in story.
Yeah.
And how does that, I guess, coexist with...
Okay, because the world is not one way. Self is not bad. You know, you are a freestanding creature. You need to eat, propagate, keep yourself from being eaten by the dinosaurs. You know, I mean, you have things you need to do as an animal to stay alive and to survive in your culture. In your mesh network where power relationships exist and everything else. The self is important for that, and the reason you tell stories, the reason your ruminating mind exists, is because it's a survival mechanism. The reason you get in your car, you don't learn how to drive a car every time you sit in the car. You've got habit pattern. You got, you know, you're 99% habits. And you've tailored yourself to have some useful habits to help you survive. You could say all of those come together under the rubric of the self. But if you to see them as that, and yet to also recognize that there are moments when I'm not, when the self isn't really present. And man, that's a relief. Like I'm saying, when I'm at work, you know, and I'm grinding away for hours and hours on something, that self is really useful to me. And boy, do I want to get away from it sometimes. Just one second. So, the self isn't bad. It's useful. But this other also exists. And this other is seeing the way you construct yourself, seeing the way we construct the world around us, so we don't cling to it as though it's either true or false. It's provisionally useful. And when it stops being useful, there must be some other perspective that would be more useful. That would, and it's all, I think, clustered around, can I feel that I'm living in harmony with what it is to be a human in a culture, in community with other people? And so there's a saying that Diane always quotes from Ken Wilber, which is, all perspectives are true and all perspectives are partial. That's what I'm saying when I say provisional. There's a billion perspectives, and they're all useful for something and not useful for something else. So what you're trying to do in your practice is simply become more fluid and recognize, and I really mean recognize, be startled by finding yourself completely on a monorail of your story. And the example I always use is when I started practicing when I was a judge, and about six, seven years later, I went back into law practice. And when I was in law practice the last time, you know, I would get migraine headaches. We used to fight within the firm with each other more than we fought with people outside. It was just really one hell of a grind. And I thought, I'm going back into practice. This is going to be... I just hope it isn't like that again. And I remember early on, you know, I was had some case, and some lawyer, you know, was doing what lawyers do to each other. You know, I don't know how to exactly describe it. Be jerks. They're just jerks, you know. They just make unreasonable refusals to do things and all. And I'm starting to walk out of my office, and I'm starting to get really steamed. And I have a bad temper. And all of a sudden, I stepped out of it, and noticing Michael is about to go off again. And I started laughing. And you know, it was a moment when I noticed him doing that, and I wasn't him. And I've enjoyed my practice ever since. That's, you know, almost 20 years ago. So that's where you want to go, so that you can say, that truth is no longer useful. That perspective on the world is no longer useful. Yes, you had something. You got a mic over here?
Yeah, I was just with relation to the ego and trying to figure out how I fit in the system, because mm-hmm. I know I'm needed, but also not attaching myself so much to what my idea of what the system needs for me. I think that it's kind of a balance of, I was talking to my partner today about, like, people reach peaks and then they go down, and then they reach peaks and then they go down, mm-hmm. because they're always looking, their ego is always, or their self is looking for those moments of happiness. But when you're able to bring in that meditative peace and balance with the awareness, those peaks get a little lower and you kind of hang out mm-hmm. in this more neutral space. And I think that that's where the suffering and disease doesn't like to live.
Well, I think it's true that you... To the extent that you think your goal is happiness, in other words, it's happiness. How would you define happiness? Something other than what you are right now? Something else. Well, something else is where? It's never here. Right? You may get something that feels like happiness, but what is all inevitably going to happen?
You're going to want the next thing.
There's going to be another moment. So you're going to have something, the Buddhist, you know, greed, anger, and ignorance. You have something that you want to keep. But can you ever keep anything permanently? Things always change. So as soon as you have it, like the smell of a new car, you know, it's going to go away. But that isn't to say you're deadening yourself, but if you're just in the moment and this body-mind is feeling that it's in its optimal state, you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to get anything. Happiness is not somewhere else. Happiness is not different than this. But you can take this and make it something else. But it's always here. So, you know, we say in Buddhism, in Zen, we're not here to give you something, we're here for you to lose things. To lose your attachment to something that isn't here. And as I say, don't worry. You're still going to know how to drive your car. You still, hopefully, will have the good sense to know when somebody's infringing on your boundaries. You'll also know when you can afford to be generous to people and compassionate to them, because it doesn't threaten you. and because they're like you. They just happen at the moment to be stuck in a pretty hard place because they're grasping onto their story. You get in a fight with your partner, what do you got? You got two people embedded in stories, right? Neither one of which is fitting what the other one wants or expects. So you can cling to your story. There may be truth in it, and it may be it's time to end the relationship, but it could also be that if you both communicated, you might find that you were stuck only for a moment in a story, because you have a lot of stories, and they get prompted by all kinds of things. Yeah.
I wonder if you could just spend a moment more talking about how do you know when it is time to hold a boundary? When is it appropriate to take a stand?
Those are questions of skillfulness. And I think the more, there's those ethical questions. This isn't going to resolve your ethical questions, but to the degree that you come to feel more comfortable with change, more comfortable with dynamism, you can think of it as being able to surf the ever-changing world inside and outside. You feel more settled. And from that settled position, you're more capable of making good judgments. You know, I don't want to get too wonky on it, but one of the neurological facts is the part of us that sort of most recently developed our social skills tend to go offline when we're emotionally distressed. So our ability to sense others and our ability to sense ourselves and our emotional states kind of shuts down when we get distressed. Well, you're not going to be able to make nuanced judgments, and I don't mean judgments, intellectual judgments, I mean intuitional judgments, because you can't really sense what's happening. You can't really tell what's present because you're embedded in threat and you've contracted. So that if you can actually feel more comfortable, a better surfer of your own emotions and your relationships and change the dynamism of moment-to-moment reality, the more you're going to be comfortable deciding, when's this good for me and others? When's this detrimental? When's this a negative? Because there aren't rules. I mean, there are rules, but there are not rules. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Would you say when it causes too much suffering, going back to the boundaries question, would you say when it causes too much suffering or more suffering than you'd like, that's when you need a boundary? And I'm talking about relationships.
Sure. Well, I think, yeah. Well, then you like. I mean, I think, yeah. Yeah. Like based on this is not good for myself or for the other person. And on balance, the prospects don't seem great. Because we're all going through moments when we're stuck in our story and the other person's stuck in another story, so you're colliding. The question, can you see that? And can you see the story? And can you step out of the story? And can you then be equanimous? And they can too. And you can go through those, you get back on your surfboard and things smooth out. But there are certainly points at which you're integrity is being infringed, and you say no. So there's there isn't an automatic answer, but the more stability you have in your emotional state, the more you open up neurologically and the more able you are to perceive what's going on in yourself and others, and the less afraid you are. And the less afraid you are, the more life isn't so scary. I'm not so threatened. Yes.
Well, what I'm hearing you say is that sometimes suffering can be attributed to the story.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes suffering
is real.
Attributed to genuine harm.
Yeah.
And that with experience and learning to be more present, we can have more intuition or discernment about what's truly present, and then be able to create effective boundaries that really, when applied, can bring about life-affirming experiences.
Yes, yes, and this is a place where our intellectualizing isn't necessarily the best answer. Because intellectualizing is doing what I said about chunking, taking chunks out of your experience and making them more than they were in the moment. The more you construct stories about what's correct in your head, the more you're at risk of imposing again doing that. This is always nuanced. You have the capacity not to just be this all the time. You can be this and you can be this, depending on what's needed. But what's needed has to always pay attention to your homeostatic state. What is appropriate for me as a person in this moment under these circumstances? Some of those are ethical guidelines. You know, we all, Buddhism has like 10 precepts that don't sound a lot like, you know, a lot different than the Ten Commandments or 10, you know, every tradition. Socrates would give you, you know, a list of things that aren't different than what Jesus would have said. Those guidelines are there. The question is always, how do you apply them in the moment? And the more sensitive you are to your circumstances and everybody else, the more nuanced you can be.
We get better at correct application.
Yeah.
When we're able and to really consider context.
Yeah. Better discernment of everything. It's all nuance. Yeah. So, is there anything else? You know, we could sit for a while. You want to sit or do the gonger?
Check with me if it seems we want to go on. Okay, we'll sit. If you'll sit up in your chairs. I'll give you some instructions. Focus your attention on the sound of the bell as it fades.
sit with a certain dignity. Bring your attention to your breath and your body. Find the place where you can most sense the sensations of breathing. And as you begin a breath, an inhalation, blanket the sensations with your awareness. From the very beginning of the inhalation through the exhalation. Notice all the places in your body that are where sensation arises as you breathe. Now I'd ask you, while maintaining awareness of the breath, open your sense of awareness to include everything arising in consciousness. Even if your eyes are closed, you'll have a field of vision. Keep it as wide as possible. Sounds, your external sensation of your body against your clothes, against the seat, light, smell, taste, sensations in your body. Let them all arise in the space of your consciousness. Don't identify them with a part of the body. Just notice all of the things that are coming up. Some of them will be vague. Just be clear about their vagueness. Some are sharp. Bring them into focus. All the while holding your awareness as open as possible. Be aware of things shifting and changing within the field of your awareness. New sensations arise, old ones depart. Your interior state shifts. Just be present. If a thought arises, make it the subject of your attention. Watch it dissipate. Come back to open awareness. if at any time the effort to hold open awareness feels fatiguing, concentrate on the breath. Focus all your attention on the breath for several inhalations and exhalations. Then again, go back with that reinvigorated attention and expand it to include everything. When thoughts arise and you focus on them, you might ask where they came from. When they go, you might ask where they went. Just one more phenomenon in your consciousness. That's all there is to it.